Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
All right, welcome back to Heritage Radio Network on Tour. My name is Kat Johnson, and I'm here with Hannah Forden, my cohort from Heritage Radio Network. Today we're broadcasting live from the Slow Food Nation's Taste Marketplace. We're in downtown Denver, beautiful downtown Denver. The weather is perfect.
It's incredible.
We're at the corner of Larimer Street and 14th Street. If you're in Denver and you're listening, come down and see us in real life. If you're not here, I hope you're listening to us live at heritageradionetwork.org/live. Right now, we are joined by Carrie Balcom. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you.
Carrie is the executive director of the American Grass-Fed Association, which is the national multi-species entity organized to protect and promote grass-fed and pasture-based farmers and ranchers. It is the leader in pasture-based production and the oldest grass-fed certification in the U.S. So, Carrie.
Yes.
Tell us about how you came to work with the AGA.
My background is I grew up in rural South Florida on a cattle ranch, and then I was very involved in the food movement through the Chefs Collaborative and other things. And when AGA started in Denver in 2003, I was at the first meeting, and I've been here ever since. And not only are we the oldest certification, we're the only grass-fed certification that's USA only. So our animals are born and raised in the United States. So we think that's important for American family farms and farmers.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about why that label is important for people when they're shopping and important for them to know that the grass-fed beef is actually raised here in the U.S.?
It's important because, again, we're trying to support American family farms and farmers, and without the certification label, we have a thing going on right now called the 10,000 Mile Meat Campaign, and we have a link to it on our website, and we're asking the government to change that loophole where product can be brought in from overseas, and once it hits the United States, can be repackaged and then be labeled product of the United States. There are statistics out, one of my cohorts that here, they did DNA testing on a hamburger that they bought in a grocery store, and it had the DNA of 1,000 animals in it.
Oh my goodness.
So wow. We need to know your farmer, know your food, but if you can and when you go to the grocery store, you should be able to trust the labels.
So tell me a little bit about what you're participating in this weekend at Slow Food. I know we saw you yesterday at the summit, and then recap that a bit, and what are you up to the rest of the weekend?
Well, yesterday was very exciting because we had a thing about supporting rural economies, which was
fabulous, by the way.
Thank you. I had my friend Greg Gunthorpe, who won the Snail Blazer Award last night, and then Mike Calicrate, who's a farmer rancher from Colorado Springs, and we did a tag team of trying to explain what we're trying to do about keeping family farms and supporting the rural economies. And instead of extracting all the wealth from the rural economies, is putting these families back on the farm so that they can make a living and support their local communities and keeping that part of our economy alive and functioning.
What are some challenges that are facing farmers and ranchers that the AGA works with?
Well, first thing is the thing right now that's critical is the labeling. Mm-hmm. Because 80% of the grass-fed that you find in the grocery stores and in retail in the United States is probably from offshore. We don't know exactly, but we're thinking probably 75 to 80%. The other is that in trying to explain to people that not all animals are grass-fed, they start grass-fed, but then they go to feed yards, and that's not healthy for the soil, that's not healthy for the animal, and that's not healthy for the farmer. Because it's the only market that they have. We're trying to create alternative markets. Distribution, and something we talked about yesterday, was processing, so that we can get that food to you without a lot of middle people going on. And for people who can't go to the farm or don't have access to farms, who live in urban areas, to know that when they do pick up a package of grass-fed, which they want, because that it really is grass-fed.
Yeah, that was a big issue in the conversation yesterday, was mislabeling and kind of how to hold the industry accountable. And I know you mentioned you've been going to Washington and lobbying and doing your best to make sure that everything is labeled. Yeah. If it is from the USA, it is labeled as such. If it is not, then it is also labeled as such. What are some of the challenges you face, like, trying to fight on that policy level? Because on the grassroots level, it seems like you're doing amazing work, you're here, you're connecting with farmers, but on the policy level, it must be challenging.
It's daunting. The food system in America, we let it get away from us.
Yes.
And it by design, and we hope. And we had policy people in the 60s and 70s. Earl Butts historically said, "Get bigger, get out," and we bought into that, that it was better. And then all of a sudden, we realized that that's not good for anybody except corporations, mm-hmm. because that's bottom line. So we're trying to undo that very, very systematically. And there's a need for what we're doing. We don't lobby, we advocate. But we meet with USDA a lot, and we work very diligently to make sure that the farmers that we work with and represent are heard. 90% of the farmers that the USDA represents are small family farms. So we think that we have a large voice that needs to have a voice in the government, and we don't have that right now. Mm. So we spend a lot of time in Washington, and we pound on a lot of doors.
I think one of the main conversations that's coming up this weekend is around regenerative agriculture, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering if the AGA does any sort of work or is representing some farmers who are really striving for that model.
Yes. The pasture-based production model inherently makes that happen. However, there are steps and levels that you can go up so that you're increasing carbon, that you're doing all these other things. Because if you are just putting animals out on pasture, that's okay. But if you're trying to restore the soils and you're trying to increase your herd size and you can have more animal carrying capacity and you're increasing the amount of carbon that you're sequestering and all of those things, and healthy soils mean healthy animals, which means healthy planet, which means healthy community. So we work very closely with Savory Institute. We work very closely with Holistic Management International. In fact, we're partnering with them with our conference in October, and also with Quivera, which Quivera started probably 20 years ago with a group of ranchers and environmentalists who got together and said, okay, we need to start working together. So we work very closely with those people. None of our animals are fed in feed yards. So regenerating the soils, restoring the soils is very important to our ranchers and farmers because they live there. Mm-hmm. They're not absentee landlords.
And I'm not like...
it's their backyard.
Yeah, I'm not like incredibly familiar with like what a regenerative farm might look like for a rancher specifically, but what are some like other maybe crops or animals that would be on a ranch for someone who's raising grass-fed beef?
Well, let's just take, we have people who are, there's Greg Gunthorpe who's here, and he has pastured pork, he has chickens, he has turkeys, and he has ducks. And so he rotates everything through. And so when something finishes here, that he puts something else on the pasture, and then different bugs, they do different things with the soils. This is happening all over the country. You take Hearst Ranch, who's working on the same thing. Mm-hmm. They're a large mass of land, but with what they're doing, with trying to do restorative work on Hearst, you've got Tomcat in California. You've got Will Harris in White Oak Pastures, he's got a great little movie out. It's called 100,000 Beating Hearts. So it's not being monoculture in any respect is what we're doing. So you have the large animals, the ruminants, you have the, and then you have the small animals, and then you have organic crops, and all of that feeds into the system.
So it's the same concept as rotating crops that we like kind of all learned in maybe elementary school, but it's the same thing with animals, and maybe people don't recognize that you can farm animals in a very similar fashion as you can crops.
Yes, yeah.
So what are some other ways that you work with individual farmers like Will Harris or Greg Gunthorpe?
Well, we spend a lot of time with them because they're our spokespeople, and we send them out to people who want. Let me just take, for example, my father and my grandfather and my great-grandfather were doing restorative farming, regenerative farming, but they didn't call it that. So there are a lot of farmers who are doing the right thing, but there's little small nuances that they can change. And they can stop this practice, which makes this practice better. It's a step situation that works out. We're working right now on setting up a series of webinars for homeopathic and naturopathic medicines, and we're hoping to get that off the ground here shortly. We work with them very closely on trying to get their labeling done. We work with them very close to try and help them find markets. Some of these farmers are very small, and we try and get them to aggregate so they have enough supply to feed into a supply chain and a distribution system. There are the farmers that just want to sell off-farm, and that's great, and that's wonderful. But for somebody who wants to sell to a food co-op or to a small grocery store chain or whatever, you need larger numbers of animals to make that happen. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So you're also going to be participating in part of the Chef Summit tonight.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of talk are you going to be doing tonight? Is it similar to what you did yesterday?
Pretty much. I taught culinary for about 10 years here in Denver. And so listening to the chefs are such an important part of what we do because they have such an amazing voice. And we have people like Rick Bayless. And you have people all over the country and some of the local chefs like Daniel Asher and those people who are buying from local farms and farmers. And when they go into a restaurant and they put a farmer's name or they do a taste thing. And a lot of people, when they taste grass-fed for the first time, they'll say, oh, it tastes different. You go, thank you, you noticed. So that's important. And they know how to take the product and turn it into something that's good for the palate. And they take whole animals. So you'll see a lot of those places where they don't have just ribeye on them or pork. They'll have pork or beef. So they take the whole animal and they use different things in different parts. And let's see, what else are we doing? We're working on the 10,000 Mile Meat Campaign on the labeling. We're working on Cool. We're working, you name it. I've got a bag full of stuff I'm going to hand out later. And then yesterday we did a thing about slow meat. And I don't know if you saw that.
But, no, I did not say that.
Okay, well, slow meat started in Denver probably 15 or 17 years ago. Matt Jones and a few of us got together and said slow had never talked about meat before.
Mm.
And lovely Matt Jones, who was the head of slow here in Denver for a while, said, let's start talking about meat. And we did, and we had the first one was called Westward Slow, Turning the Herd. And that morphed into slow meat. And yesterday we talked about bringing all of the humane treatment of animals, pastured animals, how we can make that more the consumer more aware of that.
So where can folks learn more about the American Grass-Fed Association and the work that you're doing directly with farmers and to advocate on their behalf?
Well, of course, we have social media. And we have a great website that we're working on revamping as we speak. You can sign up for our e-alerts and as a consumer, which is great, and there's no cost. You sign up and then we send you stuff, not more than about once a month or once a week, unless we have something really important, like the 10,000 Mile Meat Campaign that we're working on right now that we'd like to get as many signatures as possible, and it's just a little click and you say, I support this, and it's all right there. But that's the best way to do it. And if you want to go to farms and if you want to learn, then we can put you in touch with farmers who actually will let you come onto the farm. Because some farms aren't really set up. They're families, and they're not really set up to have tourists or visitors. But for those, we know which farms you can visit.
Great. And another question that just popped into my head is the 10,000 Mile Meat Campaign and the other advocacy work you're doing, does any of that tie in directly to the farm bill that's happening right now?
Yeah. The farm bill is this huge thing, but the farm bill, that's legislative.
Mm-hmm.
The 10,000 Mile Meat Campaign is policy.
Mm-hmm.
So policy is easier than legislative. So we're working very diligently with the USDA we don't want a share of their pie. We'd like to have our own pie.
Mm-hmm.
So we're working to try and a one size fits all. Doesn't work anymore for agriculture. And we're trying to make that distinction for our farmers. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And if it doesn't make sense for anyone out there, you can go learn more at the American Grass-Fed Association website.
Well, I have learned over the years that we all speak different languages. That's one thing we found in slow meat yesterday, that we need to work on the language.
Mm.
And we talk about restorative agriculture, where we're restoring the lands to take them so that they can self-support themselves. And, you know, with animals on pasture and what that means and why that's important and all those things. And chefs, of course, speak a completely different language.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's why, you know, Slow Food Nations is important because we have conversations where there is overlap.
Yep.
And, I mean, like the session yesterday, there were farmers, there were distributors, there were, you know, restaurant owners and, you know, activists. And so everyone brought something different to the conversation. And it helps to find a common language.
Yeah, it's amazing to me from the first one, how this has morphed into something that's really amazing and sometimes overwhelming for us who are, you know, like, where do I go next? So I'm glad that I get to sit with you guys for a little while.
Oh, so are we.
In the shade. So you were here last year at the Slow Food Nations.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, what did you love about last year that you were looking forward to this year?
Well, I enjoyed all of it. It seems a little more cohesive this year.
Yeah.
Things are a little more, every year that you do something like this with this huge of a crowd, it's hard to control. Krista Roberts and the group from Slow Food Denver have done an amazing job of bringing this thing together.
Yeah.
And Thursday night, Slow does a thing at Denver Botanic Gardens, and I do their food for the lecture series. And she said, "Can you do it the night before Slow?" And I said, "Well, of course. we're gonna keep doing the work. With all these people are coming to town, and it's important for you to be somewhere else and do something else."
So yes.
I think every year it gets better.
Yeah, and this year is great. The weather's great. I definitely, we're so happy to have this awesome tent set up. Last year, there were, you know, panels happening all over the city, so I was running from one place to the next with my recorder.
Yeah.
And I really love that everyone gets to come hang out with us at our tent this year.
Yeah, and I'm thrilled that my friend Brian Kinney is sitting there somewhere in the background listening to me.
Hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
We miss you.
Wish you were here.
Well, make sure you have to be here, Brian.
Yes, we're gonna work on that for
okay.
sure. But Carrie, thank you so much for coming and talking to us.
You're quite welcome. I am so thrilled to have this opportunity, and I'm sorry that Will can't be here, but he has a great. I'm sure if I can talk about that for just a moment.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Will has this really neat concept that's opening up. There's a solar farm that's opening up near where his farm is. And he's working on making a deal with the guy that's building the solar farm to graze under the solar. So not only are they going to have renewable energy, but they're going to have restorative energy. And they're going to redo the soils, and the animals will come in and graze underneath. And it's a win-win.
It's such a cool idea. We were emailing with you and him to do this interview, and it came up last minute, and obviously an opportunity that you can't pass up.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I just can envision these giant solar panels in the middle of South Georgia with sheep grazing underneath them. And I love the term regenerative energy.
Yeah.
Restorative energy.
Restorative energy,
So cool. So we will, at Heritage, also keep in touch with what Will's doing and bring more on that.
Well, we're really excited because a lot of communities have taken goats or sheep, and grazing right of ways and things like that, mm-hmm. but this is huge. Mm-hmm. Will's one of the trendsetters, and he made a commitment in 1995 to do this. And he called me and he said, "I'm going to do this." And we went, and you take a big hit when you do that, especially in South Georgia where he is. But he's got a beautiful farm. He's got a beautiful family. His daughters have come back with their spouses to run the farm and to be part of the farm, and he's got great people. And if you have the opportunity to go down there, he's got agritourism on the farm, he's got cabins, he's got everything. So it's really important. And if you happen to email Will, please know that he's not yelling at you with all caps. That's just Will.
It's so true. Every email is all caps, and it's like, it takes an adjustment, but
it's Will.
It's okay.
It's okay. He's not yelling at you. He's just, that's the way Will types.
That's how he types.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap things up with Carrie Balcom from the American Grass-Fed Association. And once again, I want to thank our sponsors that made it possible for us to be here at Slow Food Nations, Hearst Ranch Beef, the Julia Child Foundation, and our friend Julia Schaefer. And we will be back in just...
Julie Schaefer.
Hey,
Shout
Julie.
Out to Julie.
Yay! We'll be back in just a moment. Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carrie.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.